This is Games as a Podcast. Today, we are very pleased to be joined by Mr. Al Reed. We both worked with Al at Sega, where he was first the fearless leader of Demiurge, a studio that Sega acquired, and then also he was very kind enough to head up product management for Sega Networks, where he helped skill us up in the areas of product management and alignment around all those important topics that make games interesting and fun to players. He combines amazing technical smarts with business acumen. He's a serial entrepreneur and was a pleasure to work with. So I'm really excited to catch up with Al and see what he's been up to and dive into some meaty topics. Thanks, Al, for joining. It's great to see you.
Thank you for having me. It's great to see you both.
Hey, so Al, I remember the first time I talked to you was before you became a part of Sega, and you were pitching this great game for Xbox Live Arcade that was very Contra-like, and was called Shoot Many Robots, and was such a fun experience, such a great personality. And from that moment on, I could see that your team just was bubbling with creativity and had a lot of interesting things that you wanted to do with games.
Yeah, Shoot Many Robots was, I think it was like, I guess it was like indie before indie was cool, or maybe it was around the time indie was becoming cool. It was like Castle Crashers era.
Yes. Yeah.
We were trying to do four player co-op, run and gun with an interesting different sort of Borderlands-y. I don't even know that Borderlands had come out by then. Mm-hmm. Sort of RPG stuff. It was a blast. We still get the occasional email from a fan saying, "Why can't I play this anymore?"
So, that's great.
Yeah, gratifying.
It's both good and sad to hear.
Yeah. I mean, those games hold up well. The technology has not really changed what the experience would be. So they stand the test of time.
Well, why don't you take us on a quick tour so you can tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I was a graphics programmer in the beginning of my career and started a studio, which was like that's a generous term for it because it was like myself and some college buddies. Grew that mostly doing consulting, like work for hire consulting for much larger studios like Epic and Gearbox. And then when mobile was getting going, we decided to take a crack at that, sort of when the iPhone had first come out. It seemed like a lot of fun to be able to make smaller games. And we ended up being sort of, in the West anyway, very early to the party of free-to-play. And made a very successful mobile free-to-play game called Marvel Puzzle Quest, which led me into Chris's warm embrace, which was awesome. getting to join Chris and Sega Networks. And then around COVID, worked to spin Demiurge out of Sega again, which was an adventure of sort of financial engineering. And then about 14 months later, the company was acquired by the Embracer Group. And I guess I should, in there also, I did a startup selling cars on the internet, because why not? And then
the time to be doing that during COVID.
Well, the cars on the internet was before COVID.
Oh, okay.
Thankfully. Well, I don't know. It was selling cars on the internet is hard. I can talk about that at great length, but that's not terribly germane. So joined the Embracer Group. I was a board member, sort of hung around there shortly, did a fintech startup. I was like, video games, they're a harsh mistress, and I think it's very easy to think the grass is greener. And so one time I thought the grass was greener and I thought I should sell cars on the internet, and that turned out to be a bad idea. And then I thought the grass was greener in fintech and ended up building software to help large financial institutions manage their regulatory compliance, which is like very similar to video games, obviously.
Totally. Next time I have trouble going to sleep, I'll hit you up for the source material.
Unbelievably boring. I mean, you can find interesting stuff in anything, it turns out. And I learned, you know, it was fascinating to see how this other, like, completely different part of the world to work. The way I put it is, in video games, you come into the office on Monday and you say Happy Monday. And in finance, you come to the office on Friday and you say Happy Friday. It's just like very different attitude towards work and life. So that company was acquired by someone who you wouldn't have heard of unless you're in financial services. And my co-founder and I started a company helping my co-founder from that company, and I started a new company a little over a year ago, building tools for the Unreal Engine, which has been really, really wonderful. And then also at the same time, for the past couple of years, I've been doing solo development on making nerdy strategy games, which has also been a blast.
That sounds very fun.
My true passion is maybe nerdy strategy games. I don't know. I like it.
Awesome. And can't wait to dive a little deeper into that. Go ahead, Ethan.
Yeah, I was going to say that what seems to be the through line is that entrepreneurial spirit, being your own boss, making sure that you're doing your own thing and that you're working with people that you've loved to work with in a past scenario, but not necessarily under a big umbrella or a big company.
Yeah, I mean, Demiurge got pretty big. Demiurge was 100 people.
Wow.
Is 100 people, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know it got that big. It makes sense.
Yeah. I think when we were all working together, it was maybe 40.
It's a lot of happy warriors.
A lot of happy warriors. Yeah. In general, I like small. Small is awesome.
Yeah. And going back to that time, boy, you jumped in at the right time, because I know that now mobile is quite a red ocean. It's very competitive, very hard to get in there. And you had a solid idea for a game with exactly the right license, and it still lives to this day, and that's a pretty remarkable thing.
Is there a period or space of video games that was easy?
That's a good question. Right.
When was it easy?
I think the difficulty parameters shift. There, you know, different platforms come and go, and it's just different types of problems that you're coming and trying to solve.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, it's never easy. I agree with that.
Being exactly the right time at the right place, though, with something like free-to-play mobile is definitely more profitable than being in the right place, right time for VR or something like that, right? Much as I love some of the companies doing...
Yeah, the right time has not come. Yeah.
Right, right, exactly.
Yes, totally.
Yeah. Unless you're Palmer
that
Lucky.
That has never existed, so yeah.
Yep.
Right. The right time is 2035. Yeah. No, I think it's true. So we were doing mobile, and actually wasn't hard when we were doing it. You have to do the right thing, which turned out to be free-to-play. And actually, also, Demiurge's services business in sort of 2020, 2021 was phenomenal, because so many teams needed to grow really, really fast. And having a sort of trigger-ready group of developers was a very good business to be in.
Yeah. Well, it's also tough because your group was able to make games that, in my opinion, were just as good as Marvel Puzzle League. But sometimes, again, like if it's not exactly in the right window with that built-in audience, it's a tough climb.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You can see that with a couple of many things we tried to do after that never quite worked as well.
Right.
And Marvel Puzzle Quest is still doing fine. It's still profitable. And another team is running now, but they're still, I'm in like, you know, the like Marvel Puzzle Quest Facebook group, and I see people still posting and very excited about it.
Yeah. It's definitely benefited from probably Disney acquisition and keeping that IP just shoved down the throats of all the public.
Yeah. Yep. Never-ending series of movies. Yeah. Yep.
Very cool. So, Al, are you playing anything that is besides League of Legends that is captivating you?
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a weird gamer. I play almost exclusively multiplayer games, competitive multiplayer games. Mm. I don't know why they tend to strike me, but like I will play MMOs by myself just because there's other people there. But recently, yes, I still play. Unhealthy amount of League of Legends. I built a racing simulator. We were talking about the man cave before the show. I have a little racing simulator, so I play a lot of iRace. Been playing a lot of iRacing. Mm. And I'm playing one of the games that I run now called Subterfuge, which is a mobile strategy game, competitive multiplayer mobile strategy game. I've been watching a little bit of my son play Schedule 1, which is the flavor of the week.
Tell me more.
It's a modern drug war, and he's 14, so maybe I shouldn't be having him play this game, but whatever, it's fine. We're the parents that the other parents don't like having, like the bad influence parents, because we just let our kid play whatever. That's not true. We are more informed and sort of smarter about what we choose to play. But Schedule 1 it's a modern take on drug war made by a single solo developer. It's a distinctive art style in that it looks like it was made by a high schooler. The art is, I'm sure other people like the art is like, I love the style, and I just see bad art, but whatever. It's one of the pains of being in the industry is maybe a little bit of cynicism. Like, very, very cleverly designed, very competently executed. It's getting great reviews. And I think it obviously, I think, took off because it's a sort of inflammatory, sort of sexy, eye-catching topic.
Edgy,
that's the word I'm looking for. Yeah, but it's like incredibly well, what little I've, you know, watched my son play. It seems like incredibly well executed, much better than you would expect an individual to have pulled off on their
own. Maybe an amuse-bouche before Grand Theft Auto 6 drops.
Yeah, I think they also like really good market timing, right? Like if they been to come out. Right. So there's like all this, like everybody wants Grand Theft Auto and someone's like, you know, bag weed and sell it to people. It's like, that's good enough. I'll take it.
You know, I would love to have been a fly in the wall when Nintendo announced Chinatown Wars Grand Theft Auto for the original Nintendo DS, because it was a fantastic game, but the Drug Wars minigame was what got people so excited about it. It's very similar to what you're talking about.
The number of developers I've talked to who have like, who've had on, you know, we all have the like list of games we want to make, who have, someone should remake Drug War on it, myself included, like it's sitting in a document. Yep. And like, we all don't get around to doing it.
But there's something there. Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. And then I've been playing a bunch of, I'm thinking for my next game, I might make a racing management game. Hmm. So I've been playing like every car racing management game I can find, which is tedious. it's been an interesting experience because I don't find any of them fun, which is really convenient when you're setting out to make a game. You're like, I could have easily spent 6 months of my life making this game like this one and I can play it now. And I'm like, oh, this isn't fun at all.
Well, at least they spared you the trouble then.
Yeah, exactly. It's nice.
Are you you're the team manager and you have to manage like the drivers? Is it like a football manager, but applied to F1 or something like that?
Yes, it is. It's sort of what you would expect. Exactly. Yeah, there's a couple of F1 branded ones. It's like, right. But for some reason, football manager, I don't know. There's like, but maybe for, I've played 10 minutes of football manager in my life, but like you end up, you're like, watch cars run around in circles and you're like, pit now and choose these tires. But mostly you're just watching a dot on the screen go in a circle, or if it's fancy, a 3D car racing around a track. And then you spend a bunch of time like upgrading your facilities and investing in research and hiring. There's a little like Fallout sheltery aspect to a lot of them. Huh. Or tiny
set the price of caviar.
Yeah. Exactly. And you like recruit sponsors, and but the like moment to moment gameplay in all of them seems just boring. Like, and I love this stuff, but I find it boring.
Well, something I remember always thinking about when games like Deer Hunter and Kim Kardashian were popping off was like, if there's a topic that's popular enough to have a monthly print magazine at Barnes & Noble, there's probably an audience big enough to support that as a mobile game.
Oh, yeah. And there's like tons of, obviously, racing games are like a super popular genre. And the management games, I guess it sounds like F1 Manager, which was an EA game, I think it wasn't EA, it was Frontier. It sounds like this last year, as 24, is going to be the last one, just there isn't enough of an audience.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. I would have thought that maybe because of the Drive to Survive series on Netflix that there would be a healthier appetite.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. If you can't make an F1 game work in the current F1 mania, maybe you shouldn't, like, something is wrong with the game.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, it also doesn't align with the fantasy, right? Like, I think that's part of the problem that they kind of tripped into is, like, they're very focused on this one little race series with 12 cars and 12 personalities or however many it is. Mm-hmm. And, like, you give people that fantasy and they don't want to pick sponsors. They want to drive a race car. Like,
yeah, I think... It's funny that, Ethan, that you mentioned Kim Kardashian, because I almost think you kind of have to go that route to make it work, because F1 is really a lifestyle brand, right? Mm-hmm. It's the lifestyles of the rich and the famous and the fast and the furious. I feel you kind of almost need to like have it be more of a cultural wrapper for a game, mm-hmm. As opposed to something that hardcore petrol heads get into.
Secret sauce to those types of experiences are always having someone leading the production that eats, sleeps, and breathes stuff. Right. So like Miles Jacobson, like that guy is football manager. Right. Yeah. That's the only job he'll ever want in his life. Yeah. And he's perfect for it.
Yep.
But it sounds like you really do understand the intricacies and ins and outs of racing. And that's what would be needed. Somebody who's a fan of that category wants to play something made by someone who is just as big a fan, right?
Yes. And then it also has to be fun.
Yes, yes. Well, and it's so interesting with the racing games, even on mobile.
Necessary, but not sufficient.
My association generally with racing on mobile has been that they've been these graphical set pieces, right? I remember when CSR came out and Natural Motion, like they made a game that just looked like it couldn't run on mobile. Great. You know, Real Racing, same thing. When that came out, like that was just a centerpiece. So how do you manage those expectations, the kind of graphical fidelity expectations in a category like that?
Well, I think actually that as I've been surveying the category, there have been a couple that have not, it just seems like such a waste. Like I see that the F1 Manager game has these like beautiful 3D environments, and there's another GT Manager. There's like a handful of these, and like they're putting all this effort into like the real tracks and the stadiums and this 3D model and the cars drive around. And like, if you're playing a manager, like the graphics in Football Manager.
Yeah, right.
Like, at least last time, like pretty mediocre.
Not the selling point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
I think if you're making a manager game, that's not the direction you go. And actually like iRacing, which is the racing simulator game that I play, the graphics are frustratingly terrible. I'm like, these people are making so much money. Can they please make the game not look like garbage?
Right, right.
Isn't the draw for iRacing, besides the install base, the extensibility, just the ability to mod it? So you have people that are making like real-time weather systems.
Different game. Like that? Instead of Corsica.
Oh, different
game. Modding, okay. The moddable one. And that one looks...
Which one's the modding one?
Assetto Corsa.
Oh,
Assetto
sure.
Corsa. Yep. Okay.
Yep.
That one's more moddable.
I'm not a big fan of the category, but I have enjoyed Gran Turismo, especially in PSVR 2. It's the one thing I still use the PSVR 2 for,
yep.
Honestly.
It's the only thing I ever used a VR headset for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. VR is a really... I have a Quest 3, and the only thing I now have a like multi-monitor thing, but for a long time, that was how I played in VR, and it was a great use of the technology.
Well, and funny enough, part of what really works for me in any VR game is if you naturally would be wearing headgear of some sort, which you do in a racing game, it feels less unnatural. Same thing with Batman. You know, you'd be wearing a cowl, so it feels okay, right? If you're playing No Man's Sky, same thing. You'd be wearing a space helmet. So
yeah.
That when that becomes a part of the like physical sensation, that's great. I don't have the steering wheel, though.
Part
and I'm
fiction.
Sure you have a steering wheel set up and all that.
You can't play. I mean, it's just like, yeah, the games don't work without a steering wheel for all intents and purposes.
I'd like to talk a little bit about League, since you are a big fan and still play it. Why do you think you still gravitate to it? And what do you think are the challenges for a game that's been around for over 15 years in retaining players and also attracting new ones?
New
it's
players.
Something I think about a lot.
All right. Well, so for retaining existing players, you know, they add new characters, new playable characters.
Yeah.
And they've been doing a pretty good... They've actually slowed down the cadence of that a little bit. And I think it's fine and healthy. They have these sort of like mediocre little in-game events, like they add stuff to, but it doesn't affect the game. I think one of the things that they probably learned is that you don't like change the rules of baseball. Like nobody wants that.
Yeah.
The main game stays the same. And actually one of the like weird mod ones was popular enough that now they've locked that down and that stays the same.
Hmm.
It was a way people played all random, all middle. So everybody would get in a regular League of Legends lobby and would agree to have the game randomly assign them a champion. And then everyone would stay in the middle.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't a mod. It was just something people did. And then Riot was smart enough to be like, maybe we should like make this a thing. And they did. And now it's really popular. It's another way to play the game. It's like shorter and more casual. It's much, much faster paced. They like speed up the game.
Okay. Certainly helps.
And then they have like game modes sometimes and these like weird, I don't know if it's like a monetization thing, but they'll have like little mini games inside of the launcher that I never engage with them at all. I find it dull.
So turning out hundreds of legends is good for player retention. Do you think it has a negative impact for the people washing in for the first time? Just overwhelming?
Yeah, the impression that I have, as best as I can tell, they have given up on attracting new players as something they can do. If they haven't given up, they're doing a terrible job of it. Because like they have a huge problem with like people, it's free, so people make a new account and they'll be incredibly good and they get matchmade with
smurfing.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And they just stomp everybody or stomp the handful of new players. So, like, I can't imagine picking this game up for the first time. And there's some innovator's dilemma stuff there, I think, right? Like I said, you can't change baseball. So, like, if they wanted to do something to make it more friendly, they're going to lose all their existing players who won't stand for changes. So,
well, even a decade back, I remember jumping in for the first time trying the game, and it's a beautifully made game, but I didn't continue after that one experience because I rolled out. I was terrible, of course. I was brand new, and one of the players called me a fucking noob, and it's like, okay, fair enough, but that was not... right. That was not a welcoming experience, right? And so...
Yeah. They've done a really good job, actually, with... I feel like the, like, moderation of that stuff has actually improved dramatically. They made a really interesting change. Maybe, I don't know, it was a while ago. They defaulted that basically chat was disabled for you.
Oh,
okay. You didn't see it and you didn't. And if you typed, you were only typing with people you
knew,
like in your party that you joined with to go play with other people together. So that became the default chat option, which was an interesting, I mean, sort of obvious why they do that. Yeah. They have some good, they do this interesting thing, like if you flame people, you get a couple of things. Other people can report you. They'll mute you, so you can't talk for a week or something. It's never happened to me. I've just heard this happens. And when you report someone, you get a little pop-up like a day later saying, thank you for your report. We took action on your behalf.
Mm.
There's a little feedback loop there. But it's still like an incredibly, I mean, I think it is an unfixable problem because you're on a team of five people. And if you don't know them, like other people's mistakes negatively impact you in a like pretty direct, it's not totally direct, but a pretty direct way. And like, that's just going to be frustrating no matter what.
Well, are you playing with the same group of people regularly, Al, or rolling in with randos?
So mostly? I've almost entirely stopped playing by myself. I play with a group of, I have four people that I play with. And so that is also a much, much more positive experience. So if anything, I guess if I were the product manager at Riot, I would work on making it easier for people, help people find other people they want to play with and have them play together. Cause it's a totally different experience than playing by yourself.
Yeah, it's a team based game. So it makes sense if you can.
It is. Yeah, totally.
If you were a product manager at NetEase instead, and you were trying to get people like yourself to play Marvel Rivals, how would you do that? And how sticky can that possibly be if you've spent a decade in another game?
That's the thing is, like, that's, I think, another reason why it has retained well is, like, you can't, like, it's baseball. Like, nobody, you can't replace it, right? Like, I play baseball. Like, I don't play golf. Mm-hmm. And Marvel Rivals is golf, and I don't want to go dedicate 3 years of my life to going and getting better at golf. Like, it's just a totally different thing.
Have you checked out Deadlock?
Which one?
That's
the
Valve.
That's Valve's.
No.
Okay. Interesting.
Oh no, that one is it totally flamed out now though, right? It like did really well and then it basically went away.
It's still in beta, as far as I know, isn't it, Chris?
Oh yeah, I know. I was like reading a lot about it, and I never tried it. I tried Dota, and when a new MOBA comes out, I'll try it. But every time, it's like, well, this is like good, and like they fix some stuff, and it's a little more polished. But it's not League, and I know League, and I know all the characters, and I know how to play. So like, why would I change?
So I do wonder one thing based on that, and your background. It would be particularly interesting to talk to you about it, Al. In the mobile space, outside of carve-outs like Apple Arcade, everything is free to play now. That's kind of dominated the entire category. With PC and console, it seems more like what's happened is the introduction of sports, as you said, right? Where there's your Apex Legends, the League of Legends, Fortnite, Grand Theft Auto, 2K basketball, right? There's like maybe a dozen total games that dominate the player attention. And it feels very much like sports being introduced for the first time. And if you're doing a subset of the sport, that's not enough. And if you're doing a totally...
Yeah, every so often pickleball comes out and it's like, oh, now everyone plays pickleball.
Right,
But
by and large, there's been a lot of difficulty in creating a new sport that people want to play. So like, just because you love Destiny doesn't mean you're going to roll into Suicide Squad because you love Batman. That just is not enough, even if you love Rocksteady. So why is it that in the mobile free-to-play space, free-to-play became like the one way you can do games? And with console and PC, it feels more like, again, the introduction of like a dozen games that are sports, and that coexists with kind of the traditional markets. And it seems, again, increasingly difficult for more sports, quote unquote, to be introduced.
I think those are two different issues. One is the, like, why is it hard to introduce a new live service game, a, like, hobby forever sport game? And the other is the business model associated with it. I think the business model is, I think, pretty easy to understand, which is just that the audience is too small to support free-to-play on console and PC for the most part, unless you're getting a, like, absolute monstrous number of people. I guess a little bit that audience is also way more averse. They're averse to free-to-play, and they're super averse to any sort of pay-for-power mechanic, which isn't true in mobile. So I think
that's interesting.
The business model is just much more challenging on PC and console for that reason. But the opposite is also true, right? Like every time I see some indie developer release they have a like $15 game and they release a free demo, I'm like, what are you doing? People who have Steam will gladly pay $15 just to try your game, right? Like you don't need to give it to them for free. Why would you do that? You're just cutting off like a huge swath of your revenue.
Well, a well-designed demo can help drive sales.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Even my son on his like very limited allowance, he will buy a $10 game, not confident that he's going to like it, just to try it, and he'll play for 2 hours and he'll be like, really? It wasn't great.
He doesn't have a wish list and he's not like waiting for stuff to go on sale?
No.
That's my MO. When I see a game I'm interested in, I wish list it and then I'll pick it up when it's on sale.
No, maybe I've raised a really impatient
maybe there, the FOMO is real right. That's away. One of the reasons why Ethan spends so much on
games. And like he's like on Discord with his friends and they're playing Schedule One right now and he wants to get on and play Schedule One.
That makes sense.
Well, I think it's an interesting time to talk a little bit about the pricing that Nintendo is putting forward for Switch 2, where the first party games are going to be $80 digital and in many cases $90 physical if you want them. And you know what, I'm not flinching at all. I am buying multiple copies if I want something that I can play and my kids want to play at the same time. So I have no problem whatsoever with that pricing. And I think Nintendo knows there are plenty of people like me.
When was the last time Nintendo released a game that you played for 10 hours and were done with it?
Exactly.
These are like incredibly high value. Like how many hours are there in a Mario Kart? Like,
yeah.
All of them.
Yeah, all of the hours. Exactly. That, talk about a hobby game. Yeah.
8 is 10 years old, which is crazy, right? Mario Kart 8 was the best-selling game on the Wii U and the best-selling game on the Nintendo Switch. Mm-hmm. So two generations, right? That, and so they know by launching with Mario Kart World, they can easily charge $90 for that, and people will have no issue.
Yeah, people are
going to complain. Some people seem to have issues with it,
but
we'll see.
But they'll buy it.
They're going to buy it. I mean, also, with like, you look at like the value of, like you talked about buying a $50 Genesis game, a $50 in, you know, circa 94 or whatever is $100 or whatever now. So
yeah, the price of the first Mario Kart on the SNES is like $120 in today's dollars.
Yep. With a much smaller production team. Chris and I were talking about it in a prior podcast, but you look at something like the original Contra and on NES, and that's like 45 minutes of content. Right, there are difficulty spikes so that you don't feel like it's that short.
Yep.
But it's actually just 45 minutes of content made by maybe 5 dudes, right?
Yep.
You know, Mega Man from Capcom was a Skunkworks game that the team just worked on in after hours because they were passionate about the idea and they had been told no. So it's a very different world. You can't do a Skunkworks type game like on the side that, you know, is going to blow up like that now. And it is really striking to look at just how much goes into these AAA games now. And GTA 6 is almost sure to redefine what scope even is.
As they generally do.
Which is another game is they're rumored to be considering $100 price points for that, right? Which is interesting.
I think that is probably a very good idea. I mean, you look at like GTA 5 is still like one of the most, it has like a huge number of concurrent players on Steam, which I don't even think of it as its primary platform. Yeah. So they also made a hobby game for a lot of people, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the thing that they did so effectively with Grand Theft Auto 5, I'll tell you honestly, Al, I have never once even turned on Grand Theft Auto Online. Never played it once. I don't really do many multiplayer games, but I've played through that campaign on multiple platforms and have bought the game probably four or five times. You know, so what I'm saying is they get both, right? They get the people that only want those amazing single player experiences and the heavy overlap with people that want, you know, a forever game.
But there's no subscription for GTA Online, right?
No, just
that's
GTA
like
bucks.
A missed opportunity.
I guess so. They're just, I think they're at such a scale, though, they don't really need to think about what best practices are in the industry. They just know that millions and millions of folks are going to play the game. They're kind of the original game as platform, I think.
Yeah, totally.
And that's the ultimate FOMO driver. When that game comes out, whether you're super angry about the price or you don't care, you want to be a part of the conversation by actually playing the damn thing.
They're probably, the people at Rockstar are probably absolutely thrilled that Nintendo cracked the seal on a $80 game, because they'll totally follow suit, right?
I would assume. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It seems very likely.
Well, and a friend of mine, when he heard about the price for the Switch 2, the hardware, he was like, wow, that is so expensive. Like, when Genesis came out, that was $129, and that was so much more reasonable. And I sent him a comparison when you add inflation, and they're almost exactly the same price. Yep.
And one you don't need a TV for.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you have a monitor built into the whole thing, which is, yeah, for sure. People don't really think about that. They've been used to a price of $60, you know, since 2005, so for 20 years.
Yep. All right, let's shift gears for a sec, going from the big budget triple, quadruple A, I'll call them now, to the indie dev. Al, you've been squirreling away as a solo dev, indie dev for the past few years. I'd love to hear a bit about that, and largely because I'd love to hear your experience, but also I personally, for me, there's nothing better than being at a self-sufficient indie development studio. You have this product that a cohort of players love, so you have this cool relationship with the players and the team that you're building in. It really just can't be beat. You're kind of small. You're able to do things. You know, of course, games being a hit-driven business, that window can sometimes be not so long. I feel fortunate that the last company I was part of, we built kind of this evergreen product that was kind of game-like, so it still exists today. People are still playing it and enjoying it, which I'm just proud that it still exists today. But I'd love to hear about your journeys.
Yeah, so I started working on I've been competitive multiplayer, right? So I've been sort of obsessed with the terrible 4X genre, like the mobile 4X genre, the like really, I say terrible, they're like wildly successful, but the
Machine Zone stuff,
Kingdoms of Camelot, Machine Zone stuff, I've been like fascinated by those games, because if you take there's a Game of Thrones one that's really good, and I use it loosely, there's a lot of fun potential there, I think, that is just missed because of the fact that it's an auction essentially to win.
Yes,
if you like look at that and then you look at real-time strategies and like PC real-time strategies, and you look at like 4X PC games, the like sort of traditional turn-based strategy stuff, there's like I sort of always felt there's a little bit of daylight between those two that maybe hasn't been totally fulfilled. And there's like if you could extract all of the fun parts, if you could extract the like terrible monetization schemes of the March Battlers and get them out, you might actually be left with a really cool game. And so I spent a very long time like pining away on my own trying to crack that nut. I'm not done trying to crack that nut yet. I think I'm taking a short break, building essentially a real-time, like 4X March Battler with different sort of fundamentally different economy and structure around it. And it turns out, those games, I don't know if you've played them recently, but like the start of a 4X is this like weird idle game.
Yeah, pretty much. Click here, click here, click here.
Click here, click here, now click here, now click here, now click here. It goes on for hours. It's unbelievable. And I was like, well, of course I'm not going to do that. That's a terrible idea. It's bad. But it turns out, unfortunately, these games have a sort of nasty problem where you need to have some progression before you get into competitive multiplayer, to make a bunch of the other mechanics work. Mm-hmm. And when you get rid of the click here, click here, click here, you're left with something that is incredibly boring for the first few days. And so I spent maybe a year or so, you know, like part-time and messing around, and I'm a mediocre software engineer, trying to find a fix, find a replacement for click here, click here, click here, and couldn't crack the nut. So I had a game that was out live for 2 years, I think. And I'd do little surges of trying to get, you know, 20 or 30 people in to play. And we had some really good playtests that were super fun, but it was always the case that the only way the playtest became fun was if we could get past the first few days. And then people could get into it and be like, it was like, if you saw the retention curves and the engagement, it's like off the charts phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't get people to that point.
And what were you having instead of the click here, were you just exposing the game more organically to them?
I tried. So the game is a little bit, was a little bit different than a 4X. But yes, I think basically exposing the game organically and at a pace that, like, if you get rid of all the clicking, it just takes a long time mm-hmm. for your barracks to get built, yep. right? And that's incredibly, like, if you got rid of all the click here, click here, click here in a 4X game, you're left with, you like fire up the game and you play for 5 minutes yeah. and it's like, cool, come back tomorrow.
Go enjoy a nice meal.
That's not great for retention. Yeah. And also that part of the game isn't fun. And it takes a long time to get to the fun of a 4X. Mm-hmm. So I tried speeding up the game. I tried introducing AI opponents. So you had something to do. The big innovation of the game that actually worked incredibly well, and I stole from another game that I took over running for a friend of mine, is unlike a 4X, instead of building and then having a timer, it actually fast forward time. So you could basically ask the game, show me the world as it will be in 12 hours. And then you could do more clicking. You could like build the next building or start the next upgrade or do whatever. And so you could plan out a day's worth of what you wanted your like workers to do and where you wanted them to march and where you wanted them to explore.
So it was just a preview mechanic to see what it would look like after you did that? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it wasn't, was more than a preview sounds is sad. That doesn't sound awesome. I had a really hard time describing this mechanic actually. But yeah, you could fast forward time and you could give orders in the future. So if you think of, like, if you played an RTS, you can hold down shift. And when you right click it, like if you right click on a map, you have like a peon or whatever, and you right click somewhere and you hold down shift, and you right click somewhere else, the peon will go to the first point and then go to the second point. Yep. So it's basically that. But you could do anything. You could attack, you could build buildings, you sort of queue up this whatever you wanted. So you could undo stuff, unlike an RTS. Well, I guess you could do it in an RTS, but it's like twitchy and fast. There was some fun in like creating your master plan, where you would figure out like what is the best build order and when do I want to upgrade my gold mine so that I have enough gold to do this other, to have this other thing happen. So there's like some fun war planning stuff that took place. But couldn't quite make it work.
So one thing I distinctly remember, we were doing research for how to get more people to play our 4X mobile game at Sega, the Kingdom mm-hmm. Conquest yeah. games. And the biggest struggle we ended up having was the consistent feedback that, well, it's not about convincing me as a single player to play your game. I would have to see my whole guild move over, right? Because like yeah, a big part of whatever yep. game they're already in, the guild is such an important thing that that's the whole selling point. Like, and it's mm-hmm. obviously very hard to get an entire group to move to a new game.
Yeah, my group of five friends that play League are never going to play anything else together.
Yeah, yeah. So then when you're looking at that, is it trying to reach new players that have yet to form those types of experiences in a competitive game?
So maybe. I think the fun thing about, one of the many fun things about making a game, you know, to like the scale of success that you need is so much smaller. And that lets you, I'm going to get to answering your question, I promise. Yeah. If you have sort of smaller, if you have a smaller appetite, if you need less in order to be successful, then you can be way more focused on a minute audience that you think is out there or that you know is out there.
Okay.
And so I don't, well, there may be guilds of 20 people and I would love for them to come play the game, I don't need to attract some 5% of people that are playing Game of War or whatever, right?
Yeah.
I can attract 1/100 of 1% of those people and be successful. And I think you can pull people away from the game if you're delivering something that is like actually unique and distinctive. And that's more fun to work on. I think probably everybody agrees anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't really look at it, never viewed it as like, oh, I've got to pull people away from this other game. It's like, I'm making a game for someone and I'm making a game for a small number of people that they're going to love. And it's a thing they will love. And when they see it, they're going to love it. And it won't matter what the hell else they're playing because they're going to drop that and go play this thing because I built a game just for them.
That makes sense.
And that was the thesis.
Yeah. And so with IDFA deprecation, like my understanding is that Forex in particular is pretty tricky to get new people on board and that it's expensive. Like with fingerprinting, I've heard that like bids can be like hundreds of dollars for certain customers.
Well, like the large ad networks that know a lot about their customers is getting better, but I think it's still brutal. Yeah. And so you're doing a complete, you're not buying users for a super niche game because that makes the IDFA problem even worse.
Sure.
Right. Like, that wasn't the strategy at all. It was also on PC, so you could play on a computer.
Ah, okay, Is Steam. It both or just PC focus?
No, it was PC, Android, iOS. I made a MMORTS that was cross-play and cross-platform.
Cool.
It's like a really smart thing to try to do by yourself. Terrible idea. It's like, let's take the hardest genres, real-time strategy, MMO, and make it crossplay, and then try to make it yourself. It's a terrible idea.
Yeah, you learned a lot about
it. I learned a lot.
Well, and did it help at all as far as your own web shot? Because then you're not having necessarily to have Apple and Google take 30%, right? If a game like that, if a lot of people are playing already on PC, it's easier to do your own web shop, I would assume.
Not if you're on Steam.
Yeah, I'm still on Steam. Though I could, yes, absolutely. That was like something you think about. But ultimately, for better or for worse, the 30% they take is worth it for the convenience to the player. And so you're stuck with it. There's just nothing you can do about it.
Don't tell Tim Sweeney that. But yeah, it seems
I think he knows it too.
He does.
It is true that if there were an alternative that was 15% and just as easy for my players, like absolutely, I would push them to go buy it there, but that doesn't necessarily exist.
Interesting.
I think one of the many large issues there is that they have your credit card information. It's queued up and it's one button away from buying. And like, that's so valuable to me as a game maker.
Yeah, it's a behavior that's ingrained in the consumer, right? It's just, they don't even think about it.
Yeah, totally.
Well, so Al, as somebody who has been a multiple successful entrepreneur who's sold your own companies, not to put too fine a point on it, but I'm sure that you're sitting in a position now that's different than 20 years from now when you were trying to make Demiurge work, right? So it's like, does your current position make it easier to take bigger risks in making exactly the kind of game you want?
It does, but I don't know that I think it's still like games are a terrible investment on the whole.
Yeah.
I think it's just not a good business, right? All of us could make way more money in another industry. I know, I went to another industry to make way more money. Like, it's just like the pay is better. Like, there's a million reasons. Like, you don't do this for the money. So I have never, when I'm working on my own stuff, I'll hire an artist in a low cost geography to work for 6 months on a very targeted small amount of the absolute minimum that I can get by with to validate the idea. But it is nice to be able to spend as much time as I want by myself working on a game, but I would never, that's great, but I think it would be a bad, especially when you're trying to make something super niche-y.
Yeah,
like you're better off just doing it on the cheap still. That hasn't changed.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
It seems more passion project-y than business model-y.
Totally. Yes. Yeah. I mean, but honestly, I think everybody who says they're making something that isn't that is kind of kidding themselves.
You're saying they're all passion projects or the other way around?
I think they're all.
I think they should be. Otherwise, you're probably doing it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of have to be. I think you look at. Yeah. It's just not a. There are much better ways to spend your money than making a video game. It's just,
I've been talking to the VCs.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, though, that's a whole other, I'd love to talk about that, but yes. I think they don't, it is very hard. I mean, it's hard to predict a winner. Yeah. The people who are incredibly good at it don't. And so you're left, well, I'm not going to predict a winner. I'm just going to be passionate about what I do. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, I'll go do it again. And that's just kind of the nature of the game.
It doesn't
business.
Fit neatly into a spreadsheet. Yeah. It's really hard to model around that risk.
Yeah, you can't. Oh, it doesn't. It's right. Yes. It's a coin flip, yeah, or like a whatever, a die roll with one positive outcome out of 6 or 20 or, yeah, whatever. Yeah. So I think you can improve your chances of success or you can reduce the downside risk by keeping your ambitions modest. And I think you see all these games that are like huge budgets that are just so miscalibrated to the risk that they're taking. Right? Like Grand Theft Auto, absolutely. Spend $1 billion making the next one. It makes tons of sense. Of course you're going to make that much. But spending $100 million on a real-time strategy, like whatever Frost Giant's doing, or you can't possibly have any certainty that you're going to be successful. And it's just too much money to throw at one thing. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, it's also not just competing with other games, but I have a 14-year-old myself, and for him, like, Nintendo's biggest competition is when the new Daredevil series starts on Disney+. That's going to lock him away,
oh, yeah, right,
doing something, yeah, totally different for, you know, a good period of time, and then he'll come back to games.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's that Matthew Ball presentation that made the rounds, yeah, that a big part of the thesis there was certainly, we're competing for hours, and there's more competition for that than there used to be. I don't know. That doesn't ring anecdotally. It's interesting that you think your son is sort of making decisions about, am I going to watch television or am I going to... I can see it on, I can see the argument on mobile, like TikTok is super addictive, just the, yeah, you know, the same way Candy Crush is. That squares for me, but I have a hard time believing. Well, you just gave me an example that I hadn't heard before. The there's a TV show, so I'm going to play fewer video games.
I also think that fractured attention is a thing too, right? So it's perfectly possible, mm-hmm, that someone's, yeah, on their phone while they're watching the Daredevil, and maybe, you know, they're playing a game and they're watching, yeah, and that's kind of hard to account for those hours. So there are 24 hours, oh, yeah, in a day, but you can actually devote more than 24 hours of attention to something, mm-hmm, you know, using the term very loosely, because, yeah, of just the nature of our split attention, yeah, or multitasking, totally, etc.
Yeah.
Right. And there are TV shows and games that lend themselves better, yep, to that. And
it's true. Yeah, actually, personal anecdote, on the Nintendo Switch, I am constantly playing some classic turn-based RPG, like one of the classic Final Fantasies or Suikoden or something like that, because that's fun to grind while I'm listening to a podcast. So it allows me a cozy kind of comfort food type of gameplay while I'm listening to something else.
Yeah. I guess we were talking about games. I play Wordle every day.
Yeah.
Without,
yeah,
fail. And that's sort of the same thing for me. I like listen to the morning news and play Wordle. That's just...
Yeah, it's a crossword puzzle. Yeah.
It becomes a ritual, right? Well, it's even with Nintendo Switch, the reason I'm so excited about the new one and loved the original so much was that they respected the ritual of playing on a big screen TV, at least for old guys like me, right? So, mm-hmm, like, that was maybe 20% of the way I'd actually play it. But knowing that they made it possible to do that easily when the family's asleep, right, was a big deal for me. So however they can lean into your current behaviors and habits. So, like, if I'm regularly listening to podcasts, then a game that fits that and doesn't try to, you know, make me choose is a pretty good, mm-hmm, idea. And that has to be the way tons of people play things like Candy Crush or 4X games or stuff, where it's just, you know, so, you do it in the background, right?
Yep. Yeah, if I find a mobile game that interrupts the audio of my phone, I won't play it. I, like, absolutely persona non grata for me.
Yeah.
I want to listen to something else while I play.
And different modes. Like, if you're a big fan of League of Legends, I'm sure that's a very much lean forward. You're fully focused on that at, okay, the moment. And you're not listening to something else in between.
Yes. No, you're screaming.
Yeah, right.
Your,
right,
teammate. That's...
Maybe you're asking your teammate if they are doing something else because they're not pulling their weight.
Yeah, exactly. Are you paying? Yeah. Were you watching the screen? Yeah, that is an 100% attention thing.
I got to admit, I feel very old now where I am, like... a constant moviegoer. We go two or three times a week, and Chris knows that this is literally true. And yet I didn't go see a Minecraft movie just because I like Jack Black, but it didn't look funny to me. And my kids don't play Minecraft. And so actually we went to go see The Elephant Man instead because they had a David Lynch thing going on at the Alamo. And that's a vibe. But it's like that movie has been more successful than Super Mario Brothers. So I'm officially in a position where, like, I got Mario Brothers, went day one, took the kids, but now I feel like what is mass market has left me behind. Like, Fortnite, I think I've played maybe 3 hours in my life of Fortnite, and it's beautiful, and they do a nice job with that Battle Royale mechanic, and I think it's better than PUBG, but I was not personally interested in more than 3 hours of it. As I said, I've never played Grand Theft Auto Online. I feel like I'm being left behind as like a mass market consumer, and that's a weird feeling.
If you don't
play
multiplayer games at this point, I think that is true, because like that just feels where most of the hours are going now.
Yep. Well, I remember when we were working together, there was a time when I was raving about Lara Croft Go and really encouraging you to play it, but you were very busy with the multiplayer games that you were loving more and learning from, so there was no time for Lara Croft. Which I understand, given what you're doing. Well, I'd love to know, Al, like, since you're probably looking at how to maximize the potential success for, you know, your ideas, like, what is going to help you with that? Is AI going to help with that? Is it going to help to get onto other platforms? Like, maybe VR is something that is super narrow, but, like, there's, you know, a space for someone who wants to be totally enveloped in a Forex game. Like, what are the, like, or Web3, or like, you know, are any of these appealing to you or would make sense to you given what you're doing?
One of the problems of the sort of small game space right now is, like, the barrier to entry and making a video game is so insanely low now, right?
Is it, like, too low?
No, of course. I mean, that's like that's the right thought experiment. To everybody who's complaining that there are too many games and I can't get noticed, et cetera, it's like, okay, so the bar is too low? Like, is that a bad thing? No, of course it's a good thing. But I do think it's necessarily, as like somebody who is professional and knows, it's like, if you've done this before, it does need to change your approach to like what you're going to make and how you're going to go about making it. But I use AI as much as I possibly can for anything that I do at this point. It's it's so helpful. And the same way that I use a game engine, you know, because you'd be crazy not to use existing technology to go do that. So I can't imagine programming without, you know, Copilot or Cursor helping me along the way at this point.
Yeah, it's like not using a calculator, right? Why would,
And like, I'm not going to wade into the legal and ethical and moral debates. It's a tool that I've been given, and whether you should be using it or not, that's somebody else's problem. You gave me the tool, so I'm going to use it.
Yeah. Believe me, it wasn't a barbed question. There's no right answer there.
I know, I didn't think you were baiting me into that conversation.
Yeah.
But like, and honestly, I'm actually kind of disappointed and surprised that the non-programming tools have not gotten better than they are. Like, it is definitely, like, when I was working on Windsor, the strategy game, I would have loved nothing more than to have saved, you know, tens of thousands of dollars by being able to create the art myself. I'm not an artist.
Yeah.
I need help. The technology just wasn't there. There was no way that was ever going to happen. And I'm a little, I guess I'm not surprised that I can't be an artist, because I'm like truly, truly terrible at that stuff. But I am surprised that the art has not been accelerated as much as coding.
I think it has to a degree. And going back to, it's a tool, right? So because you're a programmer, it's an incredibly useful tool for you, but you're also able to know its limitations and maximize its effectiveness as a tool. Mm-hmm. An artist, similarly, can use an AI better than say you, because they know what it's good or not good at and help it kind of iterate and maybe take the heavy lifting off of one step in the workflow for them.
I hope that is what has transpired. It's not what I have seen, like, seeing artists work yet. It has not become like an artist who's working on textures and models, not concept art, obviously, is like that ran away from everybody. And that seems I mean, I think the iteration there, but the, like, if you look at the, like, really meaty part of game development, I have not seen artists go 5x faster, like, that you hear, you know, software, maybe software engineers are twice as fast or whatever as they used to be, but I haven't seen that happen with art. But maybe I'm, as you said, just not there myself, so I don't experience it the way they do.
Well, so Chris has heard me paraphrase this before, but Francis Ford Coppola was noted for saying at one point that the best filmmaker in the world is some 14-year-old girl in Oklahoma, and you'll never know it if you don't give her the means to actually create her work. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, at the time he was talking about video, and he was talking about just recording things digitally. But now, obviously, with AI and games, you could make a similar comparison where maybe the next Neil Druckmann, right, the next John Carmack, you know, they'll finally be able to do alone or with a team of three what used to take 200 people. And as a result, you'll get something brilliant you would not have seen were the technology not making it happen.
I think we're already there, just like game engines and stuff, right? Yeah. Like, if you set out to make, maybe not 200 people, but, like, I feel like we're, that's so far been the thing. I mean, that's the reason there's so many Steam games, right?
Yeah.
It's like, just actually, you know, you can watch, spend a month watching YouTube videos and go make something.
Oh, for sure.
Wonderful.
And I totally understand the sensitivity of, like, if something used to take a lot of people and doesn't anymore, that's scary. But at the same time, I am always looking at the positive side of who does that enable to become an artist who wouldn't otherwise? And that will allow us to get our first John Hughes in games, right? Someone who can make something like a Breakfast Club type experience that people love and think about 20 years later. We don't have that yet, but we will.
And also, we all know, like, we were all working on games, right? If suddenly every software engineer and every artist and every designer under your employ, you know, you have a team of 50 or 100 people making a game, if suddenly they were all twice as effective, are you firing half of them, or are you making your game twice as big? You are absolutely making the game twice as big, because that's just the nature of the beast. And also because everyone else, you know, we're in a competitive market, everyone else is making their game twice as big, so to make, you know, a $90 game, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, I think that's a nice optimistic take. Unfortunately, I think some of the mustache twirling suits don't feel that way.
Well, one of the other things I've heard a lot of conversation about is now China is becoming a lot more successful in the U.S. You're looking at NetEase and the Marvel Rivals. But interestingly, even the Black Myth Wukong, which is a pure AAA single-player game, right? And great. It's a fantastic game, right? That's come from China. And they are very often pulling the 996 mentality of 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. And that's just not a part of what our culture typically does. I know there's crunch, right? And that happens.
At a fifth the wage.
Right. Exactly. So with that, and looking at the scaling of AI, is how do we compete with those types of scenarios when that hasn't even been a part of the picture in the past?
No, you just can't. I guess in this case, I'm in Team Chris that we're all doomed. You didn't say we're all doomed, but there was a little bit. Okay.
Well, because I was like, my thoughts lean towards, again, if you have an IP, like if you own GTA, you know, as a brand, that's going to help save your bacon. But also, if you're doing...
But Marvel Rivals was made in China. Like a big hunk of it anyway, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. You're right. But the other thing also is maybe what you're doing, again, it's roll of the dice. It's like the lottery. But if you come up with something that uniquely appeals to a small group that loves it, maybe that's the other way to do it too.
I don't view that as a lottery for what it's worth. I view it as...
Oh, good. Okay.
You're just capping your upside. No, because like ultimately, this is naive optimism. But I do think if you write a love letter to those 50,000 people, they're going to buy it. Maybe I'll be proven wrong someday, but it turns out also like writing that love letter is incredibly difficult and error prone and full of failure like I did.
Yeah.
But I think the only thing that gives me comfort about big games not all being like all of the development being sent to these incredibly talented, hardworking, less expensive teams in other parts of the world is that hasn't happened to Hollywood yet.
Mm.
And so there's like lots cultural relevant stuff that doesn't get export. Well, I don't think that's the reason. Like China could make the creative nucleus has not been able to be exported yet The unions maybe prevented the rest of it from being exported, but I don't even know that that's true. But we have not seen the, like, cultural center of the movie universe has not left what is, like, it is a tiny, tiny little part of the world, right?
Yep.
And, like, maybe that will happen with video games also in the U.S. and
I think so. I think authenticity is a big part of it, right? So Black Myth was an amazing game because it's a cultural touch point that was made in China. So it feels very authentic. And that's why it resonated so deeply with so many gamers everywhere, because they're like, oh, it's a great game. It's got great visuals. And it was delivered by a team that is very immersed in the mythology and the cultural aspects to it. So that's a hard thing to export. Like, could Red Dead Redemption have been made by a Chinese studio? Maybe if it were, you know, a Chinese mythology around it, yes. But it's kind of a uniquely American Wild West type aesthetic. And I think there's a reason why.
And unfortunately, so is Grand Theft Auto. Rockstar.
Yeah.
Yes. True.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember, Chris, when we were asking the Yakuza team to create Binary Domain, and they really wanted the experience making a third-person shooter like Gears of War. But the game was very good. However, it didn't resonate with U.S. players, in part because they insisted on setting it in destroyed Tokyo. Just as an example, right? It's like they wanted to do what felt good to them, which probably artistically was the right call. But the original ask was to try to do something for the West. And that's a very hard thing to ask people to do if that's not what they grew up with.
If you carry that to a logical conclusion, though, aren't we, like, Americans are making games for Americans and people in China are making games for people in China and people in Japan, which I guess maybe are we there? We might already be there, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, I get Nintendo is the outlier there because it's true. Love Mario and Zelda and Mario Kart, and they definitely feel Japanese.
They do,
but not in a way that feels like it's not mass market in the U.S.
Right,
and I guess that becomes more and more the case when a game isn't Pac-Man or River Raid, where it's just this basic idea that's global, because those games they will make sense no matter where you are.
Yeah.
But now you're talking about cultural nuance and storytelling and. You know, Last of Us is on television on Max in the West, and so that makes the game even more popular. Yeah. But if that doesn't have that kind of footprint in China, it might not be nearly as interesting. Yeah, it is interesting to see what the larger global audience will accept. So for something that you're making, Al, that's very niche, are you thinking about different territories, like maybe in Germany or other places that love war games that might be more popular?
So I think about it in that I'm trying to find my audience and that, like, I know what I'm making and I believe there's an audience out there, a small, tiny, tiny audience out there for it. There's a little bit of, like, searching around. Like, I was surprised that the game, which was really designed to be mobile first, did way better on Steam than it did
on mobile
from a, like, acquisition engagement standpoint. Cause it's a nerdy strategy. It was a mobile game that PC gamers would love. Because it's a, like, super hardcore strategy game.
Makes sense.
And then also, unsurprisingly, Eastern Europe and Germany were very, like, lots of the people who got hooked on it were from there, not from the U.S., because that's where the nerdy strategy gamers are.
What's the average session length? I'd be really curious to know.
For Windsor was short. It was, you know, you could play for 15 minutes. It depends a little bit, because like Game of War, the real game is the chat. So the game that it's modeled on, which I now also run, is a game called Subterfuge, which everyone should go download. It's live and has, whatever, 13 years after it came out, has, I don't know, 1,000 DAO. Is a real-time strategy game, very, very slow paced. The game takes a week, so it's like you slow the game, slow an RTS down, that the pace is whatever, 1/1000th of a RTS. And the end result when you do that is that diplomacy, you have time for diplomacy, and so diplomacy ends up being how you are successful. And so the real game takes place in the chat room. So it's like session length is a little bit of a weird thing, because, like, what's the session length in iMessage?
Right, yeah, that's a great point.
It's like really short. You send a message and then you put your phone down, but then it buzzes again 8 seconds later and you open it up.
Well, yeah, then you have sessions, you know, sessions per day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So the sessions per day for Windsor and Subterfuge are like bananas high, but that's a little bit of a misnomer because people were firing it up really quick to send a message and then closing it again.
So Al, you've worked on a number of games that have lasted for more than a decade, which seems like the ultimate outlier now, where so many games close after 1 year, despite lots of attention being put to live service and marketing. What are the things that they're doing wrong that's kind of cooking their game and making it so that they can't last 10 years? You've done it, or you've seen it happen multiple times. So there must be something that people are either impatient or they are not giving as many options for conversation within the game. What is it that's making so many of these games die, and yet you've seen multiple games live more than a decade?
It's not a free-to-play thing. It's not a live service thing. It's that the game's not good. Like, it's not appealing, okay, or it's bad. Yeah, it doesn't have its audience. It's all, like, pretty vanilla, normal game stuff. It's actually, there's nothing special about it. I don't think it is the case that live service games that flame out in 3 months or a year is because they're missing some mythical live ops talent, or they need more events or whatever. Like, that's not the reason they're flaming out. They're, because most of them flame out real fast, right? I'm willing to believe that a game that ran for a year and then sort of started to peter out, that's like bad live ops stuff. But most aren't getting to that hump where they engage and hook people or attract an audience that's then like playing it because it's fun, right? Like League had no live ops to speak of for years when it first started. It was like they'd release a new champion every so often, but like that's no different than Don't Starve releasing DLC, right? So I don't think there's
maybe a lot of the challenges intrinsic motivations versus extrinsic motivations of the game. If the game is not intrinsically fun to play, there's no amount of extrinsic motivators you can slap on it to kind of resurrect it. And I think the game industry has proceeded so quickly down this live ops games as a service thing that sometimes people don't stop to do enough navel gazing to see, is the core gameplay enough to get someone to come in and come and play? Because if you don't identify that and nail it from the jump, you're, yes, maybe you can prop it for 6 months or so with really cool systems that kind of create some sort of game, but ultimately you're gonna start to slough off. So that's my opinion.
They get vilified because they're like live ops failures, as opposed to, I think part of it is that live ops games, like a free live game, necessarily has these like huge marketing pushes at launch, because some of it's a numbers game, right? Like you need, especially for a multiplayer game, where you need critical mass and concurrence in order to matchmaking to work and all this stuff. So they go super hard out of the gate, and they get tons of players because they went super hard and they're free. And so they flame out in this like very loud way that is not like $60 game that fails quietly, right? Like it gets bad reviews and nobody plays it, and that's the end of it. A free-to-play game flames out with a million players because it's free, and everyone's like, wow, it has graphics, it looks credible, I'm going to download it, and I'm going to try it. And they have, because it's multiplayer, they've got Twitch streamers and influencers. And so when they fail, it's this like thing that everybody hears about. But I'm sure if you went on Steam and looked at all of the $60 games that released last week, there's lots of games that look the same as, you know, whatever free-to-play flame out that just happened was. I feel bad saying that, like, because we've all worked on terror. I've worked on very bad games before, and it's not because we didn't try, right? It was just like we didn't do our jobs well. That happens.
Well, the other thing is when you have the means of production through things like Unity and Unreal Engine, naturally there's going to be exponentially more slop, right? That's just a numbers game.
Yeah.
But you'll also hopefully have more games that are great. And of course, the real tragedy is when a great game simply doesn't find its audience because there's so much or something big released that month that distracted everyone.
Does that happen?
Well, I know that people are really trying to move the hell out of the space that GTA 6 is going to take when it comes out. I think people do at least deliberately try to avoid that, because that will suck all the oxygen out. Exactly. So, I mean, maybe there aren't that many games like that, but I bet you every October people want to be far away from Call of Duty.
Yes. Yeah, I guess up in that sort of rarefied quadruple A air or whatever, I can see you're like in a little bit more direct competition. I'm always very skeptical of, I think it's, people love to point to external factors as to why their games failed.
Oh, sure.
And I think most of the time their game failed because people didn't want what they were selling.
Yeah, I think that that's true.
And marketing. We should blame the marketing department, too. Let's not forget to do that. Because when in doubt, we should blame the marketing department. It's never our fault.
Al, really, really great to have you on. Really enjoyed the discussion. Before we sign off, can you tell listeners about the games you're working on, where they can find them?
Yeah, so the one that's live right now is called Subterfuge. If it's on iOS and Android, you just search for Subterfuge, you'll find it. You'll know it. It looks like a nerdy strategy game, black background and little subs that you send out after your friends and enemy. It is I wish I could claim credit for it. Like I said, a buddy of mine made it, and he was tired of running it and was going to shut it down. And I emailed him and said, no, let me take over and run it. I'll take good care of it. So we've been patching it up, which has been really fun.
Awesome. And if there are any Unreal developers out there that can help, you should check out Universal Foundry.
Give it a shot. Yes, if you are starting a new Unreal project, check out Universal Foundry. We take all of these really powerful tools that Epic provides that are designed to run in the cloud, that do make your builds, and do the sort of modern equivalent of a light bake, and we do all that for you.
Wonderful.
So you don't have to set up and run your own.
Al, thanks again. Great to catch up, and great discussion as always.
Space up your team.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Al.
Good to see you both.